We're going to reveal some stuff very shortly. It's very exciting. Some changes are coming. But hopefully they're just to make the podcast bigger and better.
Yes.
Yeah, so hang in there. You know,
Keith is going to be replaced by Ja Rule. Oh, and that's what's happening with the show now.
You know, you've now condemned me to being Ja Rule
on every podcast.
Yeah.
All you have to do is just rap like you're constipated, and you got it. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree, from San Diego, south of my area. I don't know. Keith Foster.
You don't know. From Los Angeles, north of my area, Cassidy Robinson.
Take a couple weeks off and I completely forget how to ride a bike.
I feel like we have, like, the most complicated intro. Like, why do we introduce each other? You should just say, I'm Cassidy, he's Keith, here's your movie shit.
We could do that. We can blast ourselves into the podcast. Today we're talking about Velvet Buzzsaw, the new direct-to-Netflix movie, and for the Netflix homework, which is separate from our main review, we're going to be reviewing both the Netflix Fire documentary and the Hulu Fire Fraud. So yeah, we're getting all on fire this episode.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a minute. It's been a minute since we've done a podcast episode. I feel prepared. I feel like I'm ready for this. But what?
That's good.
Let's go ahead and do a little bit of a consumo bay.
All right, we're getting right into that right away, huh?
Yeah. Okay. I got a couple things, but I'll let you go if you have something.
I don't know if I've talked about this yet on the podcast, on the pod. Mm-hmm. Did I talk about how I got a PS4?
I think so. Didn't you buy it for like one game?
Yeah, basically. I bought it to play the Spider-Man game on PS4.
Mm-hmm.
Which I just beat. I just finished like the main story. There's still a bunch of DLC. And holy shit, totally lives up to the hype. Really fucking good. And it made me want to dig back into Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies.
Oh.
So I recently rewatched Spider-Man 2.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of to see, like, you know, it's sort of held up as up until Into the Spider-Verse, it's sort of held up as, like, probably the best Spider-Man movie.
Sure, a pillar of the genre.
Yeah, for sure. And I was like, you know, how well does it age? And especially when we're in sort of a different era of superhero movies than mm-hmm. we used to be. And I totally was into it. It's still really solid. It's almost refreshing because it's so earnest. Mm-hmm. There's like nothing meta or cynical or
winking at the camera, any of that.
Yeah, it is just trying to be the best damn superhero movie it can be. And there's something about that that is very endearing. Like there's definitely sort of this artificial reality that's created as sort of this like operatic superhero movie reality that we don't really get anymore. And I do think that in general for the genre of superheroes, it's for the better that we've sort of moved on from this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was refreshing to just like go back and rewatch a movie trying to be the best superhero movie possible. And
a bright-eyed superhero film.
Yeah. I mean, it's so obviously... Sam Raimi is so obviously inspired by Richard Donner's Superman movies that it's almost a little bit like, he's... Like, is he doing that much original here or what? But it's right. just so... It's so well done to that formula that I just couldn't help but, like, really enjoy it. It just makes me sad that his trilogy ended on such a wet fart.
Right, and I wonder if that... what you're talking about, that kind of lack of cynicism or that lack of irony... that's in the first two Spider-Man movies, if the reason, one of the reasons people rejected the third one as hard as they did is because that, like, his take on, like, the black costume and stuff was a little bit more, like, self-aware and sort of snarky?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I honestly only saw that one once.
Right.
And after rewatching Spider-Man 2, I am sort of curious. I think there is more to it than that. Like, mm-hmm. I genuinely think that the third movie has some major issues. Like,
I mean, it's a thousand movies crammed into one.
Yeah, crammed into one. Yeah. And it really should have been Harry Osborn as the Green Goblin. Like, that right. was definitely the trilogy that was being set up. And I do... Because... his arc in Spider-Man 2 sets up such a good villainous turn.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it's fun to see James Franco, like,
hamming it the fuck up.
Shit. Yeah. It's really enjoyable. And so it makes me, I feel like he was sort of ripped off for his sort of starring moment.
As I recall, James Franco's performances in the Spider-Man movies is significantly better in the third one than the other two. Like, he's probably the highlight of the third one.
No, that's Thomas Hayden Church's Sandman.
Well, he's good, but he has, like, 5 minutes in the movie.
Yeah, but they're the best 5 minutes. They're the only 5 minutes that sort of feel like a worthy predecessor.
Well, there's that scene. It's weird because I've only seen Spider-Man 3 once, but it kind of imprinted on me. There's that scene where they're fighting, Harry and Spider-Man are fighting in the sewer. I remember that being kind of like one of the cooler scenes in the trilogy.
I don't even remember that. All I really remember is obviously the jazz dancing and
that's unfortunate.
But the moment that really stands out to me is, the Sandman's origin.
Coming to life.
It's like this beautiful, poetic, like, it stands sort of alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame that they, like, tried to shoehorn Venom into it. Like, maybe the two of them could have been all right. And his, Harry Osborn's fucking snowboarding non-goblin look was just a major disappointment. Like, I just really think that had they invested in that. But you know, from a movie studio perspective, I get that it's like, well, we got to have a new villain. Mm. You've already done a goblin. You can't just do another goblin movie. But that's
really the story. See, I think like they should have kind of played by their own rules anyway, but they could have done so even more and just called the Harry Osborn goblin Hobgoblin.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, they could have done so many different takes with it, but I just think that was the natural progression of that trilogy, and it's a shame that it got so fucked up at the end, because I really think it could have been something special. But
it does have its apologists now. There's kind of a revisionism going on with, and maybe it's just because there's been, you know, so many bad Spider-Man movies after that.
Yeah.
Or at least two.
Well, I don't know. I kind of want to give it a shot, so maybe I'll talk about it again soon.
Yeah, we'll have to report back.
Yeah.
I went with a group of friends a couple weeks ago. We went to the New Beverly Theater here in Los Angeles. They just reopened in December. They were closed for about a year for renovations.
Okay.
And I hadn't been back since they reopened, but we went to a midnight screening of Purple Rain.
Ooh, that's fun.
I'd never seen it before. None of us had.
I actually don't know if I've seen it. I've seen like clips and scenes, but I don't know if I've seen it all the way through.
Yeah, I remember there was a period of time when VH1 was showing it all the time, and I probably sat in on a few minutes or whatever. But yeah, this is the first time I ever saw it in its entirety, and obviously I'm aware of all the music in the movie because every single song off that record was a hit.
Sure, yeah.
I'll say, you know, it's not a good movie, but it's kind of a great movie, especially to go see as like a midnight movie experience with friends.
Sure.
Because it lives, it has that like 80s thing where it just kind of lives in its own hyper reality that you just wish you could kind of like live in the movie's world.
Mm.
Even though at the time they probably weren't aware that they were creating anything like an aesthetic.
Yeah.
But being this far removed, it just feels like a movie about Martians. But it's hilarious, sometimes intentionally. But the performances, I mean, that's really all it is. It's a concert film that has story bits in between, the different performances in the movie.
Yeah.
And the performances is what makes it. And when you're seeing it on the big screen, you feel like you're at a concert. I mean, people were like applauding after every number in the film.
That's what I was going to say is like, yeah, I remember this movie being on VH1 a lot, but I feel like it seems like the type of movie that should be seen in theaters. It should be like an event. And I think just like watching it alone on like a Saturday matinee on VH1, you're probably not getting the best experience.
No. Also, it's pretty R-rated, so I'm sure they had to edit a lot out.
Sure, yeah.
Apollonia gets super naked in the movie. But yeah, I recommend seeing Purple Rain. And I think I'll leave it at that. I'll save my other one for another day.
All right, you're gonna forget.
Maybe. But let's go ahead and get into our movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
A lot has happened since our last episode. Sundance is going on. Whenever there's a big festival, there's always a lot of news that drops.
Yeah, yeah.
And the trades are ablaze.
All right, let's just, because we got a lot.
We're going to run through these.
Yeah, so you just hit me with them, and I'll give you my hot takes.
Okay, and at the end of this, we're going to do a little bit of Oscar talk, but I'm going to warn everybody, our interest in the Oscars this year is next to nil.
Okay, you're giving away too much.
All right. Well, we'll start here. Channing Tatum might direct the damn Gambit movie himself because nobody else will.
This movie just needs to die. It needs to die.
Really?
I think so. I think all the X-Men properties just need to give the fuck up, embrace the Marvel Disney umbrella, and just let it go. Nobody wants a Gambit movie. None of the X-Men standalones have been good. No one's ever had faith in Channing Tatum to be Gambit. I just let it go. It's done.
Logan was good.
Okay, you're right.
And the Deadpool movies are good.
All right, you're right. Logan was good, but it was also... I don't have faith that a Gambit...
It's an exception to the rule. I understand that. I think that there's a little bit of a passion project feel here, and I think that given how much chaos there is in 20th Century Fox with this so-called movie universe, which we can barely call it that, I think that the chances of it being a decent movie and not connecting too much to the Singerverse or whatever the fuck's going on now, I think it could be okay. I think it could be okay, especially because Channing Tatum is going to star and is this excited to get it off the ground?
I mean, I can see that point of view. That is what worked for Deadpool, was having Ryan Reynolds so passionate about it that they did just kind of make the damn movie themselves. But
the Deadpool universe became the default X-Men universe, which by Deadpool 2 it almost is.
That's true. We could do a lot.
That
worse.
Would be a decent way of kind of like parlaying into something else that works for the series.
I just feel like Deadpool is such a... You can make him such a postmodern character that it's a lot harder to do that with, I think, a character like Gambit or Wolverine or whatever. But
right. Well, I wouldn't want Gambit talking to the screen and, like, you know, making dick jokes and stuff. But what I mean is that the world that they kind of established, especially in Deadpool 2 with the cast of characters and that kind of stuff, you could take away some of the humor, and I think it would still work okay.
All right.
But I don't know. That's kind of a very specific vision that I'm sure Channing Tatum doesn't have.
Yeah. All right.
Pete Davidson to get his own Judd Apatow-directed semi-autobiographical comedy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's my hot take on Pete Davidson. He he needs to percolate a lot longer. He's not... I don't think he's anything special yet. I think there is potential with him. But he... And I do think he's coming from a weird position of being way too famous for his age.
Way too young.
And for his stature in comedy. But, he's not... He's okay on SNL. Only okay. Right. And they push him real hard. And it's like... Right now, he just has a lot of really funny, famous friends. And I just don't think his... I think he just needs to put in more work. I think he is a talented comedian. I think he is a funny guy. I just think that right now he's sort of being given the keys to the kingdom, and he hasn't done the work to earn it yet.
I agree with that. I also have another hot take that you're not going to like.
Okay.
Pete Davidson needs to get the fuck out of SNL, because right now it is where comedy goes to die.
I'm not as upset by that take as you might think. I think right now SNL is in a rut, and I think a lot of it, I think their writers are, I think the Colin Jost, Michael Shea era, needs a change up. I don't think they're good head writers.
No.
And I think that's a lot of the problems with SNL right now. I think that that Pete Davidson being at SNL isn't necessarily a problem. I just think that he's not...
I don't think he's a great fit for the tone of the show.
No.
I mean, I don't think that SNL is particularly good right now, and that's a problem for everybody involved. But I also think that Pete Davidson's thing, when I see him, when he does excite me, is when he does what are essentially 4-minute stand-up sets.
Yes.
In Weekend Update. And that's original. That's off the top of his head. And I see that and I go, you should be in a club right now with a brick wall behind you.
I agree.
You should not be on SNL. You have a darker sensibility.
And I hate that.
And
they...
he has this kind of streetwise... It kind of reminds me a little bit of like a young Sandler, but with like more sort of world weary, like young Sandler meets Louis pre-problematic.
I agree with that more. I don't really see the Sandler comparison except in his age. I mean, Sandler was always raw, but it always had more of an absurdist bent than Pete Davidson has had.
Right, and he does big voices and impressions and stuff. But I think what I mean by that is Pete Davidson has that kind of devil-may-care, like, I'm the naughty boy kind of thing.
Yeah, you mean that because he's young.
Young and kind of rebellious.
Yeah, but and there's Sandler Sandler wasn't that rebellious.
Well, if you remember, like, back in the 90s when he had his, like, super obscene comedy albums and stuff.
Sure, but once he got SNL, it wasn't like he kind of kept that bad boy image. He was pre-Fallon Fallon.
Yeah.
We could talk about SNL for the entire rest of the podcast.
I think we don't want to go down that hole. Here's my other thing. I'm kind of sick of, and I would include this also in like the Netflix original shows and that kind of stuff. I'm kind of sick of like the depressed comedian living out his own therapy on screen.
No, I agree. I think Marin was the last show that could like really get away with it without it feeling like completely derivative. Like, I enjoy crashing with Pete Holmes, but it's also like, okay, like this is, there's nothing new here. It's
getting a little self-flagellating and self-masturbatory.
I agree. And I also, I like Judd Apatow and I like his thing, but I think he's kind of hurting comedy more at this point because he sort of swoops in and sort of mentors these young comics and then they get like their own show and then it that's become the new system.
And right. And they also sort of assimilate into a sort of comedy style rather than finding their own path.
Exactly. So I agree. I'm not super into this. I think bottom line is Pete Davidson, I think he just needs to work more in a non-SNL setting. So
he needs to get on the road and stay on the road and just like
grind it out.
Establish himself.
Yeah. Find what his voice is without his support system. Because right now, yeah. All right. We could keep going with him.
Yeah. talk about comedy with a comedian. All right. Yeah. Zack Snyder is returning to the zombie game with Army of the Dead for Netflix.
Here's the thing. My butthole immediately puckers when I hear Zack Snyder is doing anything. Right. But I don't know. I actually think that this could maybe be good. I think maybe a smaller sort of platform like Netflix versus, you know, like DC's entire movie budget. I think could be good for him. I think him sort of returning to his roots. I think it's, you know, he did a good zombie movie once. My only thing is, like, I'm over zombies and I'm over Zack Snyder, so I probably just won't watch this.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I'm terribly excited about it, but the entire enterprise does not immediately offend me.
No, I actually think, it's cool that, not cool, but I think it's better that he's doing an original thing for fucking once. But, you know, the last original thing he gave us was Sucker Punch. But I think zombie is a lot harder to make
room. I've always said, like, you know, as big of a Zack Snyder detractor as I've been for most of his career, I've always said there is a lane for Zack Snyder. He's just not in it. Yeah. He should not be doing the DC universe. He should not be doing Watchmen.
Yeah.
He shouldn't even be doing Owls of Ga'Hoole. He should be doing the Mortal Kombat movie.
Yes. Or a zombie movie. So, I think this is a good fit, but it's not necessarily, I don't think I'm the target audience.
Yeah, I don't exactly care, but I'm not mad.
Sure. All right, next story.
Okay, there's a lot to talk about here, actually. Matt Reeves talks the details of his noir Batman film.
Okay.
Did you read his, his description?
No, give it to me. Hit me with it. So far, I like the words noir Batman. I like that Ben Affleck is not involved. I did hear, and this might still just be like a total rumor, but right now, like in the lead for casting is Robert Pattinson, which I'm not going to be all our Twilight Pats butthurt on it. I'm not like super excited. But tell me this thing, this blurb.
Okay, yeah, I'll read the deets here off the article. He says, and he's talking about his screenplay here, or what he plans to do with his screenplay. It's very much a point-of-view-driven noir Batman tale. It's told very squarely on his shoulders, and I hope it's going to be a story that will be thrilling, but also emotional. It's more Batman in his detective mode than we've seen in the films, the comics that have a history of that. He's supposed to be the world's greatest detective, and that's not necessarily been part of what we've seen in the movies so far. I'd love this to be one where when we go on that journey of tracking down the criminals and trying to solve a crime, it's going to allow his character to have a nice arc so that he can go through a transformation. That just makes me cry, like with tears of joy.
Yeah. That's like exactly like what I've been saying.
Like since he understands what the character is.
And what the character needs. I've been saying this since The Dark Knight. Like, this should have been the follow-up to The Dark Knight. So, I'm not super stoked about Robert Pattinson, but he's not like a deal breaker. This sounds really exciting to me.
I don't think that's been confirmed. I don't think that's, yeah. I think that might be an in talks at best.
All right. You think that's enough on that story? I'm into it. Bring on Matt Reeves, Batman.
Yeah. Same here. I think he's a great fit, and he's a really good, I don't think he's like got his due yet as far as like people really understanding how good of a filmmaker he is, but those Planet of the Apes movies are fucking brilliant. And the ones that he did, the last two, and I like the one before that too, but those are really good. Cloverfield is like even to this day underrated, I think.
Oh, I didn't realize that was him. Oh, interesting.
The first one, yeah.
I actually don't really know Matt Reeves, so but it sounds like he
comes from that whole like J.J. Abrams Bad Robot world.
Yeah, well, it sounds like he gets what the character needs in a movie. Like, why do another Batman movie unless we're getting something different? And this is what I want to see is this side that we've never seen before. So into absolutely. It.
Yes. Okay, what's the next story here? An adaptation of Stephen King's The Stand is coming to CBS All Access.
I'm just going to say this real quick. I'm into all the love Stephen King's been getting. I think he's got so much great source material that maybe didn't get the best adaptations in like the 80s and 90s. Right. But I'm not getting CBS All Access. I'm sick of them trying to shove this other streaming service down my throat.
Yeah, that's a big paywall that I don't see myself climbing over. No. So maybe I'll find other means of accessing it. But
yeah,
we'll see. I'll have to hear extremely good things.
All right, next story.
Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese bringing the Devil in the White City series to Hulu. Now, I think we actually covered this story a long time ago, and at that time, I don't think it was confirmed whether it'd be a movie or a series, but this was a Richard thing, because he read that book, and he's really into it.
Yeah, it was originally supposed to be a movie, and DiCaprio was in the talks to play H.H. Holmes, who was, who's known as sort of America's first high-profile serial killer, and I actually just read this book this summer, and yeah, I think it could be really interesting. I'm curious to see what they do with it, because when I started reading it, so much of the book it is about not just H.H. Holmes and him building his murder castle, but also like all of the work that it took to build the World's Fair in Chicago. Right. And so
Because it takes place kind of around the time of the Gilded Age, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of symbolism about like wealth and America origin story sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. What it is it's sort of a discovery of American firsts. And this World's Fair in Chicago pushed a lot of innovation out of America and Americans, and it like helped develop Chicago into the city it was, just sort of developed sort of modern city planning. But it's really a book about American firsts, and that includes the first instances of darkness too, with the first real serial killer. So I just hope that whatever this is, and I think maybe it would work better as a series, is I hope it doesn't lose sight of that half of the book, because that actually sort of ended up being the more interesting half, because I already kind of knew H.H. Holmes' whole deal. And so stuff about the World's Fair was way more interesting to me. And I hope it just doesn't become sort of another
horror
glorification
series
of serial killers. Like, I watched the Bundy tapes, and the whole thing just left me feeling kind of grossed out, because like they sort of glorify him in a way. Like, they don't dwell on the horror of his crimes. They make him sound like this sort of sexy bad boy outlaw, and it's like, no, he fucked dead people. Like, he's a fucking gross ass piece of shit, and he's not this like evil mastermind. A lot of what he was able to get away with was due to white privilege. Like, he looked and sounded like everyone expected a white gentleman to look and sound like. So I hope it's not sort of more of that. But I have faith in Martin Scorsese and DiCaprio. Like, both of them have sort of had their eye on this project for a while. So I think it could be a lot more than that.
I agree. And I think the fact that Scorsese's involved, his whole thing is, you know, sort of tying crime and sort of genre storytelling and telling larger, bigger picture narratives with it.
For sure. Like,
Gangs of New York and even The Departed, which is based on a Chinese kind of like action movie, he turned into
Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
Yeah. So I think, there's definitely potential for this to be really cool with the people involved.
Hulu is a service that people actually do use.
Cool.
All right. Let's just talk about the Oscars a little bit. The nominations came out. I'm just going to read the Best Picture nominations. Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favorite, Green Book, Roma, A Star Is Born.
It just sounds like the Golden Globes all over again. I just so don't even care. The Oscars are such a hot mess this year with the whole host shenanigans.
Yeah. No host.
They just reveal that four of the categories are going to be presented during commercial breaks. And it's like fucking best cinematographer and
best editor,
like film editing and like the stuff that is unique to
hair and makeup
cinema.
I have so the categories just here. It's cinematography, film editing, live action short, and hair and makeup, which is going to be shown during or given away off air.
I think this year's Oscars is such a fucking train wreck. The nominations are so uninspired and, like you said, milquetoast and just predictable and hacky.
Super safe.
Fuck.
Yeah.
The whole controversy with the host. And now this, it's like, who is this for? Like they don't even have a host. So, like, what are they filling that time with? Is it going to be, like, more musical performances? And I don't give a fuck. Like, why are they cutting this stuff? Like, I'm watching the Oscars to see the awards. The Oscars have always been sort of masturbatory and self-aggrandizing and gross. Right. But this is just, like, even worse. Like, they're cutting it shorter for what? The live audience? Like, I don't give a fuck.
For more Oscar selfies or whatever's gonna. What bothers me about it is, yes, obviously I've never really looked at the Oscars as being like the true mark of great cinema, like these are the definitive best films of the year. But I there's a friend of mine who posted a thing on Facebook about them cutting out these awards from the telecast, and he made a good point that to a young kid growing up in Idaho, and he actually used that reference, which is weird, but watching
is he not from Idaho?
No.
That's weird.
Watching
we are
exactly watching the Oscars as a kid, and you might not be from the industry or anything like that, but you kind of get a peek into what the world of, you know, Hollywood is, and you get to see sort of like these other aspects of what goes into filmmaking. Now I think they're kind of like, what bothers me about this is it's exactly the slippery slope that the Grammys took, and now they show maybe three or four, I don't even know how many fucking awards they show on that because I haven't watched it in decades, but almost the entire show is just performances, and they give away almost all their awards off air.
Yeah, and it's
dropping the pretext of awarding art or artists,
and it's also doing it for ratings, which is so gross, and just like fuck off with that. I just
And also the categories that they decided to cut are bizarre. Like, okay, if you're going to come to me and you're like, you have to cut four categories, we just have to do it. It's obviously sound editing and sound mixing and the shorts.
Yeah. I mean, but even that, I agree. Yes. Like, cinematography is insane.
Guillermo del Toro had a really good tweet about this. He said, you know, cinematography, and I'm paraphrasing, cinematography and editing is cinema.
Yes.
Like, yeah. That is what, that distinguishes cinema from seeing a play or reading a book.
For sure. Like, I honestly don't even really want to watch them this year. And that's the other thing is, who is
this? If I couldn't, I wouldn't be sad.
Who is this for? Like, supposedly the strategy is to boost ratings. Nobody likes any of this. They tried to do the fucking thing with, like, best popular film, which everyone was like, fuck you.
Yeah, which everyone was like, what are you doing? So they scrapped that idea in the last minute. And then, of course, they throw on Black Panther and Bohemian Rhapsody and Stars Born and these kind of, like, populist movies to kind of boost ratings. And I'm sure, like, those movies have been seen a lot more than, say, something like The Favorite, which is, if I'm going to have a pick here of what I'm hoping wins, I kind of hope that one, because that's the most, like, you know, an auteur-driven film.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed A Star Is Born. That wouldn't make sense to me. But, like, Black Panther, get the fuck out of here. I'm sorry. Fuck you, Black Panther. Like, I get why people are excited about this movie. Mm-hmm. And I, for a long time, have wanted to see, like, a comic book movie. Just in general, fantasy or sci-fi, or just sort of, you know, the stuff that fires my nerd engine is usually overlooked. But, like, the one that you're choosing is Black Panther. Like, fuck off. It's such pandering bullshit. Like, Black Panther wasn't even the best superhero movie that came out last year. It's not the best picture. Like, I think both, Avengers Endgame and fucking Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse make more sense.
Black Panther. And I know that there's a lot of people who are going to say that it's, you know, culturally significant because of the fact that it's was a huge success and had a large African-American cast and an African-American director.
All of that
and
stuff
I get all of that, but here's what I'll say about that. Blindspotting and Sorry to Bother You, I'm sorry, are objectively more interesting, better movies that are actually about that.
Yes, exactly.
And, like, got completely ignored. I was hoping to see, like, my dark horse, no pun intended, was I was hoping to see Sorry to Bother You for best screenplay.
Sure.
Because that's usually where the weird ones happen.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I agree completely. It's like, all of that stuff is true of Black Panther. And that's mm-hmm. great. All of those things are great. It doesn't mean it needs a fucking Best Picture nomination.
I talked to Richard about it recently because we hadn't talked about that movie, and he said he had just recently seen it, and he said it's okay. It's an okay Marvel movie, slightly better than Doctor Strange.
But
I think that's about the right assessment. It's an above average Marvel movie.
Even for Marvel though, I think it's sort of middle of the pack, right?
Right.
And so, it's just like, to me, that's even more offensive because of all of the great fucking comic book movies and sci-fi movies and stuff the Academy has overlooked for years, like fucking The Dark Knight, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Black Panther is going to be the one to fucking break that ceiling, but it's not because it's a good movie, and I'm not saying it's bad. I liked Black Panther, but it's
right.
It just so obviously for political reasons that it just really
annoying.
Jades me, and I just don't care about the Oscars this year, but whatever.
No. So that's all there is with that and the movie news. Let's go ahead and talk about some weird movies.
Yeah, I'm just going to be yelling for the next 45 minutes of this podcast.
Don't go down a hate spiral.
It's not a hate spiral. It's just a loud spiral.
Don't inundate me with your hate waves. Let's go ahead and describe to me, if you can, Velvet Buzzsaw.
Okay. We're in the art world of, I'm guessing, like,
Los Angeles. The high art world.
Yeah, the high art world of, like, galleries and art critics and selling paintings for absurd amounts of money. You know, very high competition, sort of money-driven aspect of art. And this woman who is sort of, like, on the bottom rung at her art gallery, and she's, like, looking to make some moves and impress her boss. Her neighbor happens to die, and she's there when he dies. He just sort of collapses in front of his apartment, and she discovers all of these, like, masterpiece-level paintings that she collects, and she gives to her gallery to sell, and so she becomes sort of high profile in the art world, and the art world is sort of abuzz with these Dies paintings, this sort of hidden master, who, you know, I think, like, the romantic story about how he, you know, wasn't appreciated in his lifetime just adds fuel to that fire. But it turns out that he was hiding some sinister secrets, and these paintings are cursed. And so the people who profit off of them start dying off in strange, mysterious ways. Yeah, that's basically it.
That's it. This is written and directed by Dan Gilroy, longtime screenwriter, but he particularly caught my eye back when him and Jake Gyllenhaal did the movie Nightcrawler together, which is kind of a mini masterpiece in my mind. Great crime thriller. Nightcrawler's
fucking great.
Yeah, a career best performance from Jake Gyllenhaal. And, you know, if you haven't seen it already, take a glance back and watch Nightcrawler. Totally holds up on Blu-ray, too. Really great movie. So and when it, I saw that.
And beautifully shot.
Yeah, really, really interestingly shot. And so when I saw it, when he, you know, coming off of that, him and Jake Gyllenhaal are coming back together again. Jake Gyllenhaal plays this kind of snooty art critic who is dealing with his words coming back to haunt him through all of the negative reviews he's led, and also, you know, the different kinds of relationships that he's built and destroyed throughout his life. Rene Russo is kind of a cutthroat art dealer that we see in here. She was also in Nightcrawler. And also motherfucking Toni Collette, who is, you know, still killing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of haircut performances in this movie.
Yeah, but that's, and, I mean, that's kind of what you're getting when you, you know, or...
Yeah. This is of kind of like Zoolander, where nobody knows that they're in the world of Zoolander.
A little, yeah. Like, there's definitely some satirical elements, definitely some poking fun, but less less outright comedy, less, not totally on the nose.
Yeah, definitely attempts dark comedy. And I think we saw a little bit of that in Nightcrawler as well. The Nightcrawler is, I think, a much darker film ultimately, and in my opinion, much sharper and incisive film. But I think there is some of that stuff that Gilroy brings from there to here when he's talking about kind of like capitalism and sort of the entertainment industry as through the microcosm of the art industry. And there's stuff that you can extrapolate from this that, talks about sort of, you know, upper class societies and disconnecting from reality and humanity and blah, 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 blah.
I think you're giving this movie a little more credit than it deserves.
Well, I think that those are attempts. However, yeah,
but here's the thing.
There's a big caveat about to come around the corner here.
Well, however, I want to talk about this. They are attempts. But they're also, like, the most obvious attempts.
Yes.
Like this is – these are observations that people who have never had anything to do with the art world could make about
On their own, yeah. I mean, if you've seen any kind of, you know, anything kind of making fun of hipsters or yuppies or whatever, like, you've seen this a million times.
Yeah. And
making fun of upper-class Angelenos is not hard.
And as far as, like – the social commentary and critique goes, I don't really think there's anything new here.
No, and certainly nothing here that he didn't already cover with a lot more grace and agility in Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
I mean, my however was going to be, I think this is a pretty bad movie.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I
sometimes interestingly bad, but never intentionally interesting.
To me, this sort of falls under the sort of typical for Netflix bad. Like, it feels like there was maybe, it feels like we might have gotten a first draft. And I feel like, I feel like we get that with a lot of Netflix originals. Like, I feel like Netflix is sort of so eager to greenlight things that it sort of is just like, oh, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal's involved, Rene Russo, great. You know, like, I just feel like this movie sort of skirts with almost being interesting, but just like it falls short on every attempt to me. It's it sort of transforms into a horror movie, but it's not scary at all.
No.
In fact, it's sort of frustrating how not scary it is. Like, it feels like this could have been like an interesting episode of like Twilight Zone or Black Mirror or something.
Right.
But it just doesn't, it just or supernatural. Doesn't work here. Yeah. Like, it just, it feels, if in
it's Goof
like,
Troop.
It is, but like it never gets goofy enough to be fun, to be like,
no,
really
it never
fun.
Gets so bad it's good, which is unfortunate.
And like, they never really I think the conceit is good enough, like, you know, the supernatural thriller of this cursed artist like haunting the art world, but the movie is so interested in poking fun at the art world that it spends way too much time there, and then these sort of supernatural elements kind of creep up out of nowhere, and they never really explain it. I know the most I can really say about this movie is it has some interesting visuals, but for the most part, I wasn't really into it.
No, neither was I. And I was, you know, I was about 10, 20 minutes in, and I was like, this is kind of bad, but I don't know if it's doing that on purpose yet. Like, I was annoyed by his take of, like, the art world, and especially, like, it sounds, I don't know, it's going to sound like whatever it's going to sound like, but I really hate when filmmakers write critic characters.
Yeah.
Because they're always exactly this, which is just this completely unself-aware, in it for the wrong reasons, corrupted, like, douchebag characters who are just written to be, like, Strawman and Schadenfreude. And
you know what's the worst thing is?
What?
None of this will hurt him because he's already written everything you're saying into this movie. You are Jake Gyllenhaal's character. You are that is you right now. So everything you say is rubber, and or everything you say is glue, and he's rubber, and it's going to bounce off him and stick to you. Well, no, I'm sure agree.
I'm sure he thinks that. Yeah,
it feels so like overly defensive, and like everybody's gotten fucking bad reviews, so everybody doesn't like that person who's calling you on your shit, and sometimes they are like that, but other times, you know, maybe it's valid criticism.
And to Jake Gyllenhaal's credit, he's trying to give a performance here, and I think sometimes his trying is actually to the movie's detriment, because I think Jake Gyllenhaal thinks he's the main character.
About this movie thinks he's the main character,
except for the movie, right? He has this, like, he's given the most, like, the most arc and transformation through the movie, but the movie's not as interested in him as he is in his character.
Yeah, no, this is, Josephine is the main character, but the movie does everything in its power to make it about Jake Gyllenhaal.
Right, probably because midway through filming, he realized that's where the heat was, but, and he tried to sort of edit it in, you know, his It just feels like a mess all around. Like,
yeah,
I kind of feel like he wrote a different movie than what he directed. I feel like when he was writing this, he was writing something a lot more incisive and satirical. And then when he started making it, he's like, oh, well, the satire's not working. The dark humor's not very funny. So maybe I'll just turn it into a horror film.
I think that was always kind of there. But that element is never explained to a satisfying degree.
Right. And
it's like the way the supernatural stuff enacts itself is either laughably
so
predictable or just goofy as hell.
I think that if he had approached this a different way where people were dying in weird and strange ways, but there was some amount of anonymity or that's not the word I want to use. What's some amount of
ambiguity,
yes, some amount of ambiguity as to whether or not these things were supernatural or not.
Yeah, but
then that would have been a lot more interesting.
It's revealed in
like the 20-minute mark
in these weird like CGI moments that remove
that looks like low rent Blumhouse.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want to completely shit on this movie. It has a couple things going for it. Near the end, Jake Gyllenhaal gets a pretty fun sort of hamming it up freak out.
Yeah.
So I agree. Like, Jake Gyllenhaal's performance is interesting. And I feel like whether or not Jake Gyllenhaal's good in a movie, he's always going to be interesting. So
yeah, exactly.
You can always count on that. And that's one reason I like watching.
He's always 100% committed.
Rene Russo's fine.
She doesn't get a...
Yeah,
she gets a lot to do. She's in the movie a lot, but she kind of plays this thanklessly bitchy character.
Yeah, Toni Collette is completely wasted, and
I still really enjoyed whenever she was on screen, though.
I did too, but I wanted.
I thought that she, of all the characters in the movie, she was the one who knew what the movie was the most. Like, I feel like she was the one who like tapped into the unintentional camp.
I feel like we got that from John Dondon.
Oh,
John Malkovich.
John Malkovich, for sure.
Yeah. So that these three characters, I was sort of more interested in the whole time. And David Diggs as Domrish. Yes. I have a theory that David Diggs is going to be that new actor that will make everything he's in better.
So far, yeah.
I really like David Diggs, and he does a lot with a very little in this.
Yeah, you should see Blindspotting, which he co-wrote.
I need to. I'm a fan of him right now.
For sure.
But yeah, so him and John Malkovich's character and John Dondon is this like competing art gallery, and Toni Collette's character who like wants to move up in the art world. To me, that's where sort of the more interesting stuff is, but they're relegated to these side characters that get... Natalie Dyer has some fun stuff.
She's like the young intern.
Yeah.
The only likable character.
Yeah. So all of these side characters to me are more interesting than what's actually going on with like this whole supernatural horror thing that I'm like, I don't care. Like, it just feels like two separate movies sort of shoved together in a way that doesn't satisfy at all.
Yeah, it's mostly a disappointment. There's attempts, I think, at kind of doing, like, there's some Lynch-ish elements to it every once in a while. There's also some attempts to kind of like, De Palma-esque thrillers satire kind of thing.
So
but if we're comparing, I don't think he does really any of those things very well.
If we're comparing it to the art world, let's say that David Lynch is Jackson Pollock.
Oh boy.
And then there's Andy Warhol, and then there's whoever came after Andy Warhol, and that's this movie.
What was that? What was the hacky guy from Exit to the Gift Shop, Mr. Brain Freeze or whatever his name was?
What?
Exit from the Gift Shop, the Banksy movie about the...
Yeah.
What was the guy who took all the footage and then just copied Banksy and got away with it?
Oh, I don't remember.
I don't know. Yeah. Mr. Brain Freeze or whatever his name was.
Yeah, that's sort of this
Well, Exit from... Okay, I'll say this, actually. Exit from the Gift Shop says everything that this movie's trying to say as far as the satire goes way, way better. And I think if you're looking at, like, the dark comedy, like, with a little bit of a murder crime thing going on, and in the art world, I think that Terry Zwigoff's film Art School Confidential, which is, even for him, not a great movie, does this quite a bit better.
Yeah. Though I will say I did like the character design of Mr. Hobo. Or Hobo Man. Hobo Man.
The robot, yeah.
Yeah, but for the most part, this movie just feels flat and self-aggrandizing and not great.
Yeah, I still hold out hope for Dan Gilroy to come out and make something great again, because I don't think you make a movie like Nightcrawler and then that's just a fluke. I think there's obvious talent there. It just got away from him.
And I think part of the problem is Netflix. I think it's too easy to make movies with Netflix right now. So you're not seeing that passion come through. You're seeing sort of like, you're seeing people's first attempts at movies getting made into final drafts. So
yeah, I kind of agree. All right, let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homeworks. Our Netflix/Hulu homework.
Streaming homework, which I think maybe soon we should just like
kind of call it that.
Feeding into the Netflix brand and just start doing streaming homework. But we'll see. Maybe those changes can come about naturally. Hint, tease, hint. So let's. How do you want to do this? Do you want to break this down?
Yeah, I can do this one.
The Hulu one was called Fire Fraud.
Fraud, yeah, okay.
And the Netflix one was just called Fire, the Greatest Party That Never Happened.
Right, right. So both of these documentaries were made simultaneously, and they document the massive failure that was the Fire Music Festival, a music festival that was started by a tech bro entrepreneur wannabe named Billy McFarland, who had some early success with a metal credit card for rich millennials called Magnesis. He hooks up with Ja Rule somewhere in his journey, and
of things that Zoolander was making fun of.
Right. thematically, these documentaries and Velvet Buzzsaw do have a decent amount in common. But, yeah, so him and Ja Rule hook up to create an app for rich people to book musicians and famous artists, music artists, to come and perform through sort of like a Tinder swipe service. And to boost the potential of this app, they book this festival in the Bahamas with only 5 months to prepare for it. You know, these are a group of people, who have never built a festival before, and let alone do so in an area that was not made for housing a festival. And, it becomes a disaster, but they try to keep it under wraps because they don't want bad press to ruin it early. So they keep hyping it up and hyping it up. Billy McFarland keeps lying to investors to get more and more money to get this thing done before it's too late. And what ends up happening, and this isn't a spoiler because this was well publicized in the news, is that when the guests finally arrive on the first day, they arrive to what it was essentially a construction site that wasn't completed after a horrible storm that soaked all of their accommodations, after all of these people had paid well into the thousands for what they thought was going to be hundreds of thousands, yeah, depending on what tier service they were paying for, after they were promised what was supposed to be a luxury style accommodations for a music festival.
One of these, the Hulu documentary, they actually do an interview with
Billy McFarland.
I'll start kind of going into the, like, the differences between the two.
Sure.
They actually get an interview with Billy McFarland. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, a little bit more background information on who he is and right. sort of like the rise of his sort of scamming behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And the other documentary is seen from the point of view of the people who were like publicizing employees. The event and putting on the event and stuff. And so another huge part of this story is Fuck Jerry, which just bear with me here, audience, if you don't know what Fuck Jerry is, because I'm barely understanding it, but my brain can't handle the internet sometimes. Sure. So Fuck Jerry is this sort of meme account, started as like a meme account that has become like a multi-millionaire media company.
Right.
And so they're really successful at doing like viral campaigning. And so they were hired to hype up this fire festival. And there's other stuff that Fuck Jerry's in the news for. Like they're really bad about stealing content and not crediting it. So they're no angels themselves.
Right.
And they produced the Netflix documentary.
Right.
And so to me, the whole Netflix documentary is, and I don't know. I don't know if I would have noticed it had I not known that going into it.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing to me feels like Exhibit A for the defense. Like it feels like a social media move. Like we're gonna get our story out first, so that it's harder for there to be sort of cases against us and backlash against us. And to me, the Netflix documentary feels pretty gross. I don't know. Did you get that feeling?
Well, I saw the Netflix documentary first.
Oh, okay. I watched them in the opposite order, so that's interesting. Maybe that has some effect on it.
And I saw them with a decent amount of time between, too, with about a week between them, because it was a little kind of hard to access the Hulu one. I eventually was able to see it. But I didn't know that Fuck Jerry was involved with the making of the Netflix documentary. So I was just watching it as just kind of a documentary. Okay. And my basic takeaway of it was like, I understood the larger narrative that they're trying to tell, that basically their take on the Fire Festival is that it was never really a festival. It was a dream they were trying to sell. And this dream of wealth that's unrealistic and unsustainable. And, you know, that kind of is the symbol, the ultimate symbolism of the Fire Festival is kind of like the unsustainability and of the American dream or whatever. Yeah. That's kind of their version of the story. And it's told in a little bit more of kind of a breezy, it's much more, I'll say production-wise, it's a lot more slick.
It's a little poppier, yeah.
It's a little poppier. It kind of goes down a little easier. It's not as dark. And I think it's a little bit more kind of like, there's like funny parts and that kind of stuff. And I liked it enough and I was like, okay, yeah, no, interesting story. But I wasn't like blown away by it by any means. I thought it was like a decent hour and a half of Netflix content.
Sure. Okay.
Then a week later, I finally was able to see the Hulu one, and I was kind of worried. I was like, oh, I know what's going to happen. Cause it's just, you know, like, what are they going to say? But it's a whole new world.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is like, it is night and day different
The Hulu one is a lot more...
The Hulu one, I think, is a lot more comprehensive, first of all. It tells a bigger story. I mean, it fits in that whole thing of, you know, all of that kind of, like, wealth worship and whatever.
But I think that the Hulu one is a lot more about sort of how social media and that general mindset contributed to a disaster of this scale.
Right.
Whereas the Netflix one is more like a, whoa, wasn't that crazy? I wish we weren't a part of that.
Right.
So yeah. I feel like the fire fraud one is a little more, it has a broader scope of sort of like the ramifications of what the fire festival might mean on sort of a larger scale. And to me, that was a lot more interesting. Like that they.
No,
like,
I agree.
How they.
I mean, just by like the first, because they like even when they bring up Magnesis and all of these early schemes in the other one, they just really gloss over it. They're like, he had some things, and you know, there was some other stuff he was trying to pay off, but well, it's not. And I think some of that might be that they're trying to evade things for legal purposes, but I think more so than anything, it was just they were like, let's get to the story. Like, whereas with Fire Fraud, they're really trying to like tell a bigger story.
They're trying to paint a picture of like how it really got to this point, besides just.
And it's a bit of a character study too of this Billy McFarlane character.
Yeah, and I appreciated that they actually had like interviews with him. So that
you and what they do with those interviews is hella interesting. Yeah. I don't want to give it away because it's kind of a moment. But like when that happened, I was like, oh, this is so much better. It's not even funny.
I agree, and I think maybe it was my problem that I did watch the Hulu one first, so that when I was watching the Netflix one, I was really skeptical of it. I was like, because it feels so glossy and it feels so well produced that it feels
almost like another commercial. But I think style sort of informs the content to a certain extent. They're trying to sort of like put you there into the dream of the dream. But I think that's not necessarily as interesting as what Fire Fraud is doing, which has much more of a kind of a take and a standpoint on everything that's going on here.
Well, and just like that, the Fuck Jerry and Jerry Media produced this. That was all I knew about Fuck Jerry going into either documentary. I didn't hear about like all the stuff about them stealing comedians' jokes.
That's kind of new information, actually.
Yeah, so that came. Yeah. I think that came.
That's
out,
still developing.
And I think a lot of those stories came out because of the Netflix documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they paint themselves in too good of a light in that one. Mm-hmm. Like, they throw all of the blame sort of on Billy McFarland and Ja Rule. And it's like, well, no, like, you guys knew what you were advertising. You could have pulled the plug, but instead, you actively silenced people who were critiquing the festival. Like, you have some responsibility for the disaster that happened. As much as Billy, probably not, but. Mm-hmm. To like completely sort of shirk any accountability was pretty gross, and
especially when you see the lengths that they were going to delete comments and to ban accounts.
It's like
that kind of stuff as information was leaking out.
Yeah, and at a certain point, like, you guys can say, "Oh no, this isn't real. Like, we can't ethically advertise this anymore." This is could be fraudulent, you know.
But there was so much money for everyone to make. And by the time I don't know what they knew and what they didn't know, because Billy was scamming everybody. He was scamming one person to get money to scam the next person. So, and he, you know, they always talk about him as being this kind of like car salesman type who can just sell anybody on anything.
And look, like I saw someone else post this comment and like, I've been part of productions before that I'm like, there's no way we're going to pull this off. I mean, definitely not to this scale.
Right.
Not even close. But definitely that, like, oh, God, this is all going to go horribly wrong. And then at the last minute, somehow you pull it out. So I do kind of understand that feeling of, like, it's all going to work out because it has to.
Right. And there's that one interview subject in, I think it's the Netflix version, where he's talking about, like, as he was thinking about how bad everything was, he was thinking about, like, how big of a mess Woodstock was, and how the PR and the press and the takeaway of that is still, like, a positive image in most people's minds, even though, you know, people were living in mud and they were abandoning their cars and breaking into the festival.
Fucking fires and...
Well, that was Woodstock 99, but yeah.
Oh, I thought that's what you were talking about.
No, I'm talking about Woodstock 69.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gotcha.
Where, you know, that was technically a disaster because people were breaking into the festival and making a huge mess, and their accommodations were all fucked up, but it ended up being peace, love, and rock and roll, whereas Woodstock 99 was like an apocalyptic event.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's really interesting. No matter what, I think how quickly they came out, because I heard something about how like the Hulu one kind of had to push it really hard to get their release before Netflix. And so I think like that's another thing that just made me so suspicious of the Netflix one, is just like how quickly it came out after the Hulu one. It is an interesting story, and I honestly don't think we've heard the last of the ramifications of it. You know, I mean, we're not even a full year out from the actual festival.
I don't think we've heard the last from Billy McFarlane.
I don't either.
Because there's been two movies about the dude already, and America loves these, like, rich asshole bad boys.
Yeah, one of them is the fucking president right now.
Exactly. Or, like, even Pharma Bro, who everyone hates, always gets all these exclusive interviews, and people love to talk about him. People love to hate him. I think this guy's going to do a minimum sentence in prison. I think he's going to get a reduced sentence. He's going to be out, and he's going to have a reality show.
No, kind of
Shark Tank-like reality show.
For sure. No, he was sentenced to 2 years.
See? It already happened.
No, I agree. he's not going to serve a full term. You're right. You're 100% right. We have not heard the last of him. So far, Ja Rule seems to have escaped any.
Oh yeah, he
sort
just,
of.
He just like Homer in the bush memed right out of this whole thing.
Yeah, he did. Which honestly, kind of good for him, because so far he's fucking gotten away with it.
Right.
I think this story is still developing. I think it's going to – I think the Hulu documentary is better. It's a better – I think it's objectively a more interesting angle on the story.
And agreed.
I think it's trying to get sort of a broader picture and see sort of more of a cause and effect.
Right.
I think it is definitely interesting to watch both of them.
I do too. Yeah. Especially as an exercise of just – what perspective is different, and
and how different, like, because that's something we, you know, that you don't really think about when you watch documentaries is here we have two documentaries came out at very similar times on the same subject, and they have very different points of view, and they even show some of the same footage, but they both leave you with very different feelings. So it is, if nothing else, an interesting case study in how much power there is in editing, and how much you can tell your own story in a documentary.
Right, and how documentary filmmaking is essentially editorializing.
Yeah.
So, or at its worst, propaganda.
And so I hope people kind of think about these things when they watch documentaries, but I think in general they don't. But whatever. I think if you're going to watch one, watch the Hulu one. It feels more responsible, and anything you can.
And I think it's more interesting. It tells a bigger story, and it's more detailed. I think that
and
one.
And also, fuck Jerry.
Yeah,
unfollow,
you know,
them. No, I'm. This is me saying this, not the podcast or whatever. But as a comedian, I really fucking hate everything they stand for, of literally just like stealing people's jokes and content and thinking about how to monetize it. And this is sort of, to me, sort of the culmination of that. It's the culmination of the fake it till you make it attitude. But what happens when you just don't have any talent for what you're doing?
So, which is actually also the message of both documentaries.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But fuck Jerry. Fuck them for not taking any accountability. Unfollow them, because it's the only thing these assholes understand is their fucking followers and their fucking clicks and their fucking likes.
You're going down a hate spiral. You're doing it.
I am. Okay. All right. I'm pulling out. I'm just saying, unfollow them. Every time you like one of their posts, you're actually liking somebody else's post, and you should follow that creator instead. And I'm pulling out of the spiral. All right.
The only criticism I want to give of Fire Fraud, the Hulu documentary that I say is the better of the two, you could play a drinking game with how many times they say millennial. And I think they grind into that narrative a little too much. That whole, the millennial generation, what would they do without their iPhones? I get a little annoyed with that. But
I can see that.
Because my parents are just as addicted to their devices, believe me.
All right, let's wrap this shit up.
Yeah, that is the episode. And if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about in this episode, you can email us at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Find the episodes and stream them at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. And you can follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can follow the show on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. And you can also follow the show on Instagram at Jabber Podcast.
And still have exciting news. I know it's been a little bit. Since we've talked about it, it's been a little bit since we brought it up, but we're still teasing out. We're going to reveal some stuff very shortly. It's very exciting. Some changes are coming, but hopefully they're just to make the podcast bigger and better. So hang in there.
Keith is going to be replaced by Ja Rule. Oh, and that's what's happening with the show now.
You know, you've now condemned me to playing Ja Rule, to being Ja Rule
on every podcast.
Yeah.
All you have to do is just rap like you're constipated, and you got it. What's your social media?
Follow me at Keith Foster Kid on the stuff. I'm sort of back to Twitter.
Oh, you're back. You're so back. You are so fucking back on Twitter.
You thought
you could leave it. You're right back in it.
No, here's the thing. I got accepted to Funny or Die's Pitch. Pitch is a joke writing app. And it goes through your Twitter account. So when I get like a top pitch and stuff, I'll retweet it, and that sort of brought me back in. But I don't really check it. Like, I don't really scroll through. I don't really follow people anymore.
Keith Foster Kid, just at him all day, and make him use Twitter like everyone else does. And I don't buy this pitch excuse. I think this is like Christian Bale. Like, he takes on all these roles where he has to gain weight and lose weight because he's just trying to find an excuse for his eating disorder.
No, it's. I 100% use this joke writing app way more. I don't really use Twitter anymore. I'll tweet things occasionally, but most of the time I'm just using it to use Pitch. But whatever. You can still follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter and Instagram. I'm a bit more active on. And check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. I've got some shows coming up this weekend. We have another Improv versus Stand-Up on Friday at Old Town Improv Company, 9 o'clock. This Saturday at 9 o'clock at Old Town Improv Company, we're doing a book club. It's our final swashbuckling show. And because it's our final swashbuckling show, we wanted to do something special. So we're doing a bodice ripper, lusty romance swashbuckling adventure. It's gonna be really fun. You don't want to miss it. Again, get tickets at oldtownimprov.com. Hit me up if you want some comps I can give some out.
Oh.
I'll have another Alt Comedia show the next Friday, the 22nd, Old Town Improv Company at 9 o'clock. And I think that's it. I think that's all I have to announce officially.
All right. Check out our friends out there who are doing their podcasts of their own, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast, and Mike Valick over at Hack Thought.
Also, check out our friends Meryl and Bo at Campfire Shit Show and Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast.
All right, and that is the show.
I can't save you.